Today's Talk 10 Tuesday is sponsored by Ipspalooza. Get ready to conquer the 2024 ICD-10 code changes with our expert guidance. And stay tuned till the end of this broadcast to learn if you're the lucky winner of the Ipspalooza giveaway. We've been waiting for you. Come on in. It's Talk 10 Tuesday with Chuck Buck and Dr. Erica Reamer for the 1st of August, 2023. Today, we'll announce the lucky winner of a free one-year subscription to the ICD-10 Monitor webcast. Stay tuned for that. As usual, Lori Johnson brings us the latest coding news. Tiffany Ferguson reports on the social determinants of health. Rose Dunn explains how to calculate coding accuracy. Tim Powell is at the Tuesday News Desk, and Dr. Reamer presents her talkback segment. Now, here's the publisher of ICD-10 Monitor, the host of Talk 10 Tuesday, and a player who really hopes to get picked up by the Cubs before today's trading deadline, Chuck Buck.
Yeah, trade me away. Hey, thanks, Clark Anthony. Hello, everybody. You're welcome to the 563rd live edition of Talk to Tuesday. Good morning, Erica. Hey, Erica, this is a very big day for us here at Talk to Tuesday because today we're going to announce a lucky winner who's going to receive a free one-year subscription to all the ICD-10 Monitor webcasts. And, of course, this is all part of our annual Ipspalooza celebration leading up to our three-day 2024 IPPS Summit. What do you think about that?
Yeah, well, I know during the summit, Lori's going to be giving us all the information about the new final rule, and I'm going to give the commentary.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Erica, what is the topic for your talkback today?
Today, I'm going to be talking about uncertain diagnoses, malignancy, and pathology results.
Very good. Excellent, Erica. We look forward to your talkback segment, as we usually do. We have much news to report, and so we begin this morning with Tim Powell. Tim is at the Talk 10 Tuesday News Desk.
Thanks, Chuck. And today I'm going to be talking about how the new drug law is boosting Medicare Part D benefits and keeping premiums stable for 2024. The Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services recently announced that the Medicare Part D premium and bid information was released for 2024. The most significant highlight from this announcement was that the average total monthly Part D premium is actually projected to decrease from $56.49 in 2023 to $55.50 in 2024. This development is mainly due to the improvements made in the Part D program through the Inflation Reduction Act, or IRA. The IRA serves to ensure affordable health care for Medicare beneficiaries by limiting increases in premium costs and enhancing basic Part D benefits. Now, there are two major reasons why the average Part D premium is projected to decline in 2024. First is premium stabilization. The IRA offers a mechanism that limits premium increases for those enrolled in Part D. It caps the growth in base beneficiary premium, the initial value used to calculate the plan-specific basic premium, at a 6% annual increase. This initiative has led to moderate growth in the average basic premium, resulting in lower overall average total premiums. Next is improved basic Part D benefits. The IRA also enhances the Part D benefit by capping annual out-of-pocket costs, limiting cost sharing for covered insulin products, and removing cost sharing for recommended adult vaccines. Moreover, a recent rule by CMS requires that Part D plans apply pharmacy price concessions at the point of sale rather than further reducing beneficiaries' costs starting in 2024. These adjustments are designed to provide better coverage for all Part D beneficiaries while reducing premiums for supplemental Part D coverage. With these changes, beneficiaries are expected to pay less in total Part D premiums in 2024. But how does this work in practical terms? Key elements to understanding Part D premiums are the base beneficiary premium, the average basic Part D premium, the average supplemental Part D premium, and the average total Part D premium. The base beneficiary premium is the starting point for calculating a plan basic Part D premium. From 2024, the IRA caps the annual increase and this premium is 6% per year, which has brought down the increase in the base beneficiary premium by 14 percentage points for 2024. The average basic Part D premium is calculated based on base beneficiary premium with a 2024 cap on the base premium. The average basic Part D premium is projected to increase by 7.5% in 2024. Many Part D plans provide enhanced alternative plans that offer a better benefit than the basic Part D benefit. These come with additional monthly supplemental premiums. The average supplemental Part D premium is projected to decrease from $24.40 in 2023 to $21 in 2024 due to the enhancements made by the IRA and CMS to the 2024 Part D basic benefit. Lastly, the average total Part D premium is the sum of the average basic and supplemental premiums, and it represents what people with Part D are likely to pay on an average in premiums before subsidies. CMS projects this decrease to come down from $56.49 in 2023 to $55 in 2024. The final premiums that beneficiaries will pay and Part D coverage may change and will be announced in September, before the open enrollment. These enhancements and stability in premiums will ensure that Medicare remains affordable for beneficiaries while providing comprehensive coverage. With that, back to you, Chuck.
Wow. Thanks, Tim, very much. That was Tim Powell. Tim is a compliance expert, and he's the national correspondent for ICD-10 Monitor. Now it's time for the Talked In Tuesday Coding Report with Lori Johnson. And good morning, Lori Johnson.
Good morning, and belated happy birthday, Chuck. Welcome back, Erica, and hello to our listeners. I'm going to catch up on some housekeeping this morning with regards to July HCPCS codes and Coordination and Maintenance Committee meeting updates. There are new CPT codes effective July 1st, 2023, which are published in the MLN Matters 13210, dated June 13th. There is a companion change request 13210 document which provides greater detail. The new COVID vaccine and administration codes are 0174A for the administration of Pfizer-BioNTech COVID vaccine and the bivalent for patients 6 months through 4 years. The vaccine CPT code is 91317. There are 15 new CPT proprietary laboratory analysis codes effective July 1st. The change request document will provide the detailed list with long descriptors and status indicators. The new codes fall between 0387U through 0401U. There are 20 new Category 3 codes, which that were released in January but became effective July 1st. CPT 0791T through 0810T are the codes that have been added. For example, 0793T has a description of percutaneous transcatheter thermal ablation of nerves innervating pulmonary arteries and includes right heart catheterization, pulmonary artery angiography, and all imaging guidance. There are some new HCPCS procedure codes, including endoscopic sleeve gastroplasty service C9784 with status indicator of J1. Endoscopic outlet reduction service is C9785 with status indicator of J1. Diagnostic aid service for routine functional cardiovascular assessment using echocardiography, C9786 with status indicator of S, high-resolution gastric electrophysiology mapping procedure, C9787 with status indicator of S. There are 6 new HCPCS codes for reporting drugs and biologicals with status indicator of G. For example, J1440 is new with the description of fecal microbiota live JSLM per 1 milliliter. There are 3 new HCPCS codes for high-cost skin substitute and 12 new HCPCS codes for low-cost skin substitutes. If you work with outpatient cases or you are a charge master coordinator, it's imperative that you review MLN 13210 and or change request 13210 for all the details. The next Coordination and Maintenance Committee meeting will be held on September 12th and 13th. The tentative agendas have not been posted on the websites as of this morning. And one last update. The National Center of Health Statistics released an errata for ICD-10-CM fiscal year 24, which corrected the index entry of cachexia to R64. If you remember last week, Dr. Kennedy had talked about that issue and that the coding of that as severe malnutrition was wrong. So I know Dr. Kennedy is pleased about that update. Another update was the correction of the spelling of thalassemia for code H35.2. So that's my cleanup for today. So Erica, back to you.
Thanks, Lori. Yeah, I know that the cachexia thing was a big thing that Jim noted on LinkedIn and asked people to send comments in. I'm glad it got changed. Thank you, Lori. That was Lori Johnson. Lori is a senior healthcare consultant for Revenue Cycle Solutions, LLC.
You heard us mention the IPSPALOOZA, well, it's recognition of the 2024 Inpatient Prospective Payment System final rule. The final rule is expected soon from CMS. And of course, the highlight of IPSPALOOZA is a three-day event we're calling the 2024 IPS Summit. We're producing three live webcasts to review, analyze, and report on the 2024 IPS final rule. Now, those webcasts are August 15th, 16th, and 17th, and returning once again this year as your commentators will be nationally recognized coding authority Lori Johnson, and of course, everybody's favorite CDI expert, Dr. Eric Reamer. So on day one, you're going to learn about the new ICD-10 CM codes. On day two, the webcast will cover changes to the PCS codes. And day three will be the MS-DRG shifts. They always shift. And of course, it will also include the new technology add-on payment codes. 3 days, Tuesday, August the 15th, Wednesday, August the 16th, and Thursday, August 17th, Lori Johnson and Dr. Reamer. So, Lori Johnson, during our little coffee chat, what's your reaction now to the 2024 IPS Summit? Lori?
Well, I'm excited to see, you know, we've now seen all of the code updates and the guidelines have been released. So the last part is waiting to see what they do with the DRGs and if they're going to be consistent with proposed rule or not. And another item that I'm anxious to see is the new technology add-on payments, because there were a whole lot of those introduced in proposed rule.
Very good. Yeah, thanks, Lori Johnson. And so, Erica, you and Lori have been part of this reporting team now for a couple of years. So what are you looking forward to?
Well, I'll tell you, I'm looking forward to the rule being released, and I'm hoping it's going to be on Friday. I'd like to see how it resembles the proposed rule, what additions and deletions to the MS-DRG set there have been. And I'm always interested to see what Lori's take is on it, because she always has such good insight into it.
Right, she does indeed. Thanks, Erica. And so there you have it, folks. It's a preview of the upcoming 2024 IPS Summit. It's coming your way Tuesday, August the 15th, Wednesday, August the 16th, and Thursday, August the 17th. Here now with a Talk 10 Tuesday report on the social determinants of health is our good friend Tiffany Ferguson. And good morning, Tiffany.
Good morning, all. So today I'm going to talk about part two of discussing the CMS physician fee schedule that I had covered a portion of it last week. Today I'll mention as it pertains to SUH assessments and Z-code capture in the outpatient setting. So CMS is proposing the addition of a standalone G-code that is furnished in conjunction with an E&M visit for the collection of an SDOH risk assessment. GXXX5, yet to be determined, right, could be added onto the visit for an estimation of 5 to 15 minutes, where SDOH factors based off the risk assessment are included and considered in the medical care of the patient no more than every 6 months. From an audit standpoint, compliant billing of this must ensure that the healthcare practices are using an evidence-based tool, such as the health-related social needs HRSN screening tool, which covers the minimum five domains. I've talked about this a lot. So food, housing, transportation, utilities, and personal safety. CMS is requesting comments on the incorporation of compliant billing that provides and practices are not just giving the tool, but also including the linkages into supportive services such as community health integration, CHI, that I talked about last week, or other case management services. The SUH assessment must be part of the medical record and documentation and should be considered in the ICD-10 CM Z codes, Z55 through 65, of course, captured. Additionally, this code is going to be added to the Medicare telehealth services list to allow for SDOH capture in virtual visits. The CMS proposed rule starts on page 251. CMS is also considering that there may be gaps in care delivery for patients that require additional care coordination, but not necessarily SDOH factors. This is kind of an interesting one because they kind of in the beginning talk about SDOH not being a factor for this area and then go into saying, yes, you need to include it. So let's see what comes out in the final ruling later. But it's related specifically to the impediment of medically necessary care for proposing codes for principal illness navigation, PIN. These services are focused on navigator care delivery services for serious illness called out specifically by CMS are cancer, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, congestive heart failure, dementia, HIV and AIDS, severe mental illness, and substance abuse disorder. The proposed framework for PIN services is similar to chronic care management, billing, which would be a monthly reimbursement rate for services provided under the general supervision of the physician. However, CMS ironically did end, as I mentioned, with this proposal for the PIN just by saying that you should be addressing SDOH and it would be a requirement as a portion of the PIN services. It really hasn't been clarified yet how. The title for who provides these services fall under care management and the navigator category, and they listed a bunch of them. My personal favorite for the inclusive category of titles was social worker navigator. I'd never heard the navigator added to a social worker. Usually we're just social workers. The CMS proposed guidelines start on page 259. Each of these proposed components demonstrate CMS's continued commitment to health equity and is a step in the right direction towards reimbursement for the time spent supporting patients' social factors to ensure medically necessary care. Back to you, Erica.
That was Tiffany Ferguson, the CEO for Phoenix Medical Management. Chuck?
Thanks, Erica, and thank you again, Tiffany Ferguson. And by the way, folks, you're listening to a live edition of Tucked In Tuesday.
What do you do when CMS unloads barrels of new codes into your lap like fallen leaves? How do you stay on top of your game as a coding genius? You subscribe to the ICD-10 Monitor Coding Portal. For an unbelievably low subscription of $35, you have access to the superstars of coding, Lorianne Bryant, Dr. Erica Reamer, and Lori Johnson. You also have access to more than 40 educational webcasts. Plus, you'll earn CEUs to maintain your credentials. The retail value, more than $5,960. But for a limited time, your subscription is only $35 per webcast, a savings of 75%. Subscribe today to the ICD-10 Monitor Coding Portal.
Here now with a very popular segment of Talked In Tuesday called Talk Back. And here now is Dr. Erica Reamer. Erica, it's all yours.
I hope you're not all confused by me going early because normally I go at the end. This Talk Back was inspired by an article I read by Cynthia Tang and Richard Pinson. They expressed their concern about coding clinics' advice to code an uncertain malignancy diagnosis when the pathology report was still pending. The question regarded a, quote, liver mass, comma, possibly hepatocholangiocarcinoma, close quotation marks, with the pathology still pending. Coding clinic advised that this did fall under the purview of ICD-10-CM official coding and reporting guidelines, Section 2H, Uncertain Diagnosis. This guideline allows for the coding of an uncertain diagnosis qualified with a word like probable or suspected, likely, or something like that, if the condition has not been ruled out prior to discharge or demise on the inpatient side. Coding clinic recommended assigning C22.1 intrahepatic bile duct carcinoma in this case. The idea behind the uncertain diagnosis guideline is that the resources utilized to rule out a condition are similar to the resources used to rule it in. The diagnosis-related group, or DRG payment system, is based on a statistical model recognizing that a given principal diagnosis, in the context of accompanying secondary diagnoses, some of them being CCs, some of them being MCCs, predictably costs a certain amount of money to work up and treat. Interestingly enough, landing in a less serious DRG, like acute bronchitis as opposed to pneumonia, or even landing in a respiratory signs and symptoms DRG, doesn't necessarily mean the relative weight will suffer. It's still about consumption of resources. For many uncertain diagnoses, there may be no conclusive way to ultimately determine a definitive diagnosis. It may come down to clinical judgment. However, a mass which gets biopsied is a different story. There is a way to resolve the uncertainty. We instruct our providers to document an uncertain diagnosis of malignancy if that is their considered suspicion, so that we can avoid having to query them if the pathology returns positive. My position has always been that this is important to get right for more than landing in a more favorably reimbursed DRG. The story of the encounter is not accurate or complete if a patient is found to have a malignant neoplasm, but it wasn't documented and captured. The pathology report should resolve the uncertainty. In fact, if the provider were to make an uncertain diagnosis of malignancy and the pathology to return negative, one would have to query the provider for clarification to possibly remove the diagnosis. The clinician would need to determine if they still believe there was a malignancy or if they believe the diagnosis should be amended. Pinson and Tang point out that it is, quote, always been an HIM and coding practice that coding is not completed or final billed until the pathology report is available for inpatients, particularly to confirm a malignancy diagnosis, close quote. They refer to not coding unconfirmed HIV infection, but I don't think that's a good analogy. Confirmed does not mean test proven. The provider's assertion that the patient has a condition is sufficient. So it is true that HIV, Zika, COVID-19, and certain identified influenza viruses are only coded as confirmed cases, but there does not need to be evidence of a confirmatory test in the medical record. The coder is just advised to not code uncertain diagnoses of these conditions. Is it premature to drop the claim before the pathology results return? Should the institution have a policy that the pathology needs to be reviewed prior to billing? I guess it depends on how long the typical pathology turnaround time is, how good the clinician is at a suspecting malignancy diagnoses, and how irritated they will get at receiving a query to potentially reverse their diagnosis. My personal opinion is that being branded as having a malignancy has profound implications, and it would be preferable to hold encounters with pending pathology to ensure accuracy. If a patient dies, transitions to hospice, or declines a workup, then an uncertain diagnosis resulting in coding a malignancy without confirmation might be appropriate. And with that, Chuck, back to you.
Thanks, Erica, very much. Boy, what an excellent topic that was for your talk back. And one more thing. Recently, Erica asked our next guest, of course, the legendary Rose Dunn, a question about how to calculate coding accuracy. Here now to pose her question, and again, Rose's take, is our very good friend, Dr. Erica Reamer. Erica.
So, Rose, as I told you after I attended ChiaCon, I was intrigued by a talk on coding accuracy and how there are no real standards to measure it. I asked you how you do it and how you would recommend folks calculate coding accuracy. Would you share it with us now?
Sure, Erica. We use the code over code approach that's recommended by the AHIMA publication Benchmarking to Improve Coding Accuracy and Productivity. It was published in 2009. The code over code approach uses the reviewer's codes as the denominator and the coder's correct codes as the numerator. There are times when the coder's correct codes may be zero, and of course that will lead to a 0% accuracy rating. Additionally, if the reviewer deducts for codes that the coder should not have assigned, the net number of correct codes assigned by the coder could be negative. For example, if the coder assigned two symptom codes and one definitive diagnosis code that those symptom codes supported, then the coder had one correct minus two incorrect codes or a negative one. Although it's an option, First Class Solutions stopped using a negative numerator approach. Instead, we use these situations as education moments. Code over code can be used to assess accuracy of present on admission, any subset of the code, such as the SDOHs, and other items such as abstracted data elements. Another approach that's easier to use and requires less counting is the case over case approach that is often used to determine if the correct DRG or APC was attained. For the DRG, or when there's one APC, it's either a yay or an A. If there's multiple APCs, then the code over code approach can be used. Case over case is also known as the financial accuracy rate, when it is used to reflect DRG or APC accuracy. But we all know you can get the right DRG, but not use the most specific code. So the DRG is right, but the code's wrong. Bottom line, use code over code for coding accuracy. Use case over case for financial accuracy. If you use case over case for coding accuracy, it's pretty harsh, and it doesn't give the coders credit for their correct codes.
Thank you. And so this sort of brings up the thought to me that it's my perception that a lot of coding kind of can live in the gray area. So there are some that are like obviously clearly correct, and there are some that are clearly wrong. But there are some that sort of, it could be up to the interpretation of the coder. And so sometimes one coder might say this and another coder might say that. And no one necessarily would say that either one of them is wrong. It's just like judgment. So how does an auditor, like when you guys are doing an audit or a review of codes, like how do you approach that situation?
Yeah, I think I understand what you're saying. You know, coding professionals recognize that coders and reviewers may find documentation to support their codes in different but legitimate places. When a coder doesn't agree with the reviewer, that's the purpose of the rebuttal phase in any coding review, and the coder should take advantage of that. The driver when we get into situations where there may be some gray is to revisit the documentation to see what's truly supported and then follow the hierarchy of coding rules. First, there's the coding conventions, then the coding guidelines, and then coding clinic. So to paraphrase a quote from The Godfather, take it to the index and tabular. Don't assume your encoder took you down the right path. Encoders have a way of misdirecting you. Go to the book, index, and tabular, and if that comes up with something that doesn't seem right, go to the guidelines and coding clinic. If the documentation is unclear or questionable, take it to the physician with a query. Finally, if that hierarchy of coding rules map to a diagnosis that just doesn't tie with the documentation, then there's the option to petition for a code from the Coordination Maintenance Committee, which may lead to a new coding clinic. Hope that helps, Erica.
Thank you so much, Rose. That was great.
Yeah, that was great. Thank you both. And one last thing before we go, now's the time to announce the lucky winner. That's the individual who's going to receive a free one-year subscription to attend all the ICT10 Monitor webcasts. May I have a drum roll, please?
I've got that, Chuck. Here we go.
Okay, good. Okay, good. Here we go. Drum roll, please. Very good, good. Okay, so I'm going to ask my producer, Cheyenne Leonard, to give me the envelope. I think the last time we did this was Samuel Adams one. Okay. The winner is Mary Robinson from Baptist Medical Center in Atlanta, Georgia. Congratulations, Mary Robinson. Wow, that's great. That is going to be a wrap for this Talk to Tuesday. And I want to thank our panelists today, Rose Dunn, Tiffany Ferguson, Laurie Johnson, Tim Powell, Dr. Erica Reamer, and of course, our lucky winner, Mary Robinson from Baptist Medical Center South in Atlanta, Georgia. And remember, folks, when you can't listen to us live, you can listen to all the Talk to Tuesday broadcasts on demand on Apple, Stitcher, and Spotify. When you do, give us a review. Until we meet again next Tuesday, I'm Chuck Buck. Thank you very much, and have a great week, everybody.
Talk 10 Tuesday is a production of ICD-10 Monitor.